This episode of Higher Ed Social is brought to you by Top Hat, the teaching app that makes active learning come to life. Top Hat already helps thousands of college professors create their perfect course, both inside and outside the classroom. It's a suite of easy-to-use apps to engage your class, adopt incredible next-generation textbooks, or to run tests within a secure digital environment. Best of all, it integrates with all popular LMS systems and doesn't require IT approval to get started. See why professors in over 700 colleges and universities across North America already use Top Hat to power their classrooms. To learn more, visit tophat.com/higheredsocial. That's tophat.com/higheredsocial.
I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
I think we're ready to start the show. This is so exciting. Welcome.
Cool. Yeah, thank you.
So I guess we'd like to start with you introducing yourself however you feel fit.
Sure. My name is Scott Silverman. I've been in higher education for, probably 16 years professionally. Depending on how you count our grad assistantships and whatnot. I work currently at Santa Monica College. I run the Emeritus Program for Older Adults. It's a free non-credit program. I have been interested in student affairs since I was an undergrad, since I was a sophomore in college, maybe even earlier than that. Really sort of fell into the field and have never left and will never do so. And I just love doing what I do and working with students. That's really a terrible introduction, probably. I have lots of side interests. I researched social media many years ago for my dissertation. I have a couple side hustles as we speak, and some that I'm working on actively, you know, in terms of the children's book writing and whatnot. And I always just like to call myself a jack of all trades, but a master of none, although I'm working really hard on that.
I totally feel that feel. What specifically did you research on social media, and how, no offense, totally out of date is it because of everything changing so rapidly?
Oh, seriously, right? So I started in 2004 at USC in the School of Rossier School of Education, and my original intention was researching free speech and the internet and how we have to redefine free speech in the digital age. And within maybe a few months of starting class, my boss came in. I was working in student life at the time, student activities, running student organizations. He said, "Scott, find out what ucr.facebook.com is and shut it down." Because that was, you know, the early iteration of the sites. And I took one look at it. This is probably, I don't know, early 2004, mid 2004, something like that. I took one look, created a profile, said there's no way this is going away. In fact, I'm going to research this. And as you said, it's out of date from the moment I finished. I defended September 2007, and it was out of date probably 7 or 8 months before that. To be honest,
there wasn't even a news feed at that point. That was just poking. Those were just the poking days.
And poking featured prominently in my research, let me tell you. I tried to do this whole, like, almost like a Rorschach ink blot test version of a question on my research study, where I just presented a feature on social media and you had to sort of, I just let it be open-ended. What is the first thing you think about when I say poke? When I say, you know, friend request? And I had so much data, and my chair said, "This is useless." I mean, not useless. He was great about it. He was very nice, very gracious. He said, "This is great data, but does not affect your research questions. Leave it alone for now." So I just chunked it all, set it all aside. But the poke was there, and, you know, that MySpace was still a thing in 2007, kind of, 2006.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Justin Timberlake tried to bring MySpace back. It didn't work, at least as far as I know.
But he brought sexy back.
He did. He did indeed.
Brought sexy back. Some, like, ancient, like, archaeologist is going to find remnants of your research and be like, "What is a poke?"
Seriously, right? Like, I would love to go back and try to just do that same thing again and try to, like, compare and contrast or who knows what.
Hey, poking's still there because someone poked me the other day and I was like, "What? People still do that."
Wow.
But I think people go through phases.
Five people total. Yeah.
People discover that Poke still exists, and then they go and they poke people, I guess.
When it first came out and I was on Facebook, I was told that if somebody poked you, that meant they liked you.
That's
The high school version of sending a note.
Funny. See, and I'll get poked by the same person maybe once a month. Still, just randomly. I'm like, are you so creeped out about it? I just don't understand.
Maybe at one point there was an auto poke plugin and they forgot that they had that.
That's funny. I think it's a former student employee. So let's just auto poke the boss every month forever. Let's just do that.
That's amazing.
So can we talk a second about, you live in Santa Monica. That's gotta be awesome. I was there in November and it was just beautiful. Of course, fires happened the week after, but it was beautiful.
Yeah, it's great. I live just outside Santa Monica, but I love it. And we were in Culver City a little while ago. We moved in May. And this is honestly one of the best things about this job is my commute is nil. I was driving to Thousand Oaks every day for work for the last 2.5 years. And from Culver City, Santa Monica area. And the drive was just really wearing me down. And so finally, I've got a commute that's 15 minutes each way. And it just, with my kids at home and everything else, it just really just brought me so much life to take this job.
So you were, was that on the 405 that you were
taking?
Yeah,
405 on the way in. And I usually took PCH on the way down. For some reason, PCH was better on the way home. And of course, then I can kind of sneak a peek at the ocean as I was driving.
Yeah, we.
But yeah, 405 is just awful.
I have a friend that's in Castaic. When we were, we have a campus in Los Angeles in Burbank, on Alameda, and I went and filmed a video there and got dragged around the entire city to all the places where our students internship, and that was an experience. Just the whole city.
Yeah, that's great. Wait, what school do you work for again?
Belmont University in Nashville.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Yeah, I think we actually drove past your campus and I did not realize it.
That's right. The campus I currently work at, the location, it's sort of a satellite campus. I walked by it and drove by it so many times in the last 20, 30 years, had no idea it ever existed.
Wow.
So I got to work on signage. That's for sure. Got to work on signage.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you're on a separate, totally separate area or just a small part of campus?
It's a totally separate area. So the main campus is maybe around 20th Street, 19th Street, pretty close to where I'm actually living. But my campus is on 2nd Street, right near the ocean.
Oh, wow. That's must amazing. Be rough.
So, no, seriously, if it wasn't for this gigantic hotel that's between me and the ocean, I'd have the best view in the city.
I mean, but you're on a beach.
Yeah, I can't complain too much. I mean, life could be much worse.
That is true. So it's such an interesting position that you have, a demographic that you get to work for.
Yeah, it's so unique. I don't know how many positions like this exist in higher ed. You know, I know within the California Community College system, there are maybe 35 colleges or districts that have a program like this. It's called Emeritus. So think about, retired faculty, Emeritus faculty. That's the name of the program. And it's totally designed as a non-credit, zero-cost program for older adults, typically people who are 55 and up, but we don't really check ID, to take classes for fun. And their classes are in art appreciation, music performance and appreciation, English literature, theater. I mean, it's not everything, of course. We're not going to offer chemistry and physics. But for my students, most of them maybe wouldn't come outside the house if not for the classes that we offer. And so they're mobile, they're active, their minds are working, and they're taking the same classes for 10, 20, 30, 40 years even. Some of them have literally had the exact same schedule for the last 3 or 4 decades, which blows my mind. And they're just absolutely thriving. And there's actually crazy research that talks about the effects on medical benefits, the physical benefits, the mental benefits of doing something like this. And it's just fascinating.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, like you said, after retirement age, not that I have much to go off of when it comes to experience with retirement, but I can imagine it being a shock to go from working 40 hours to week to suddenly getting 40 hours plus back in your life. And it's right. Like, what do I do?
I have shock just going on vacation sometimes.
Right, let alone the shock coming back, right? But the shock going on, you're right, it's totally disruptive. But these students, some of them actually, you know, they take the same classes, right? They have the same group of friends. It's almost like a learning community sort of feel, right? And I ran learning communities before for first-year STEM students. You know, the students are in the same group. They might even not like the faculty member they have, but the schedule never changes, by and large, because I think my predecessors didn't have a need to change it. So the schedule is the same. They take the same person, even if they don't like that instructor. Many of them do, of course, because they like hanging out with their friends. And it's totally paid for by the state. The state gives us apportionment dollars from, you know, the state budget, from the chancellor's office and the budget that we have for education, just like we get funding for students on the main campus with slightly different calculations. But it's really just, I mean, if there's programs like this in other states, which I'm sure there are, we should definitely be encouraging the people in our lives and our families and our friends to find programs like this, even if there's a cost, but for sure the free ones. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Well, the really amazing thing is that it doesn't just help, you know, keep them busy. It helps probably increase their quality of life, because they're learning, they're keeping their minds sharp, and they're not just sitting and watching Law and Order all night. Not that that is a stereotypical thing, but that's something my grandmother does. I do Law and Order.
Yeah, I do that too, right?
I mean, who doesn't?
No,
But yeah, you know, it does. It's mental stimulation and it's social stimulation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I really want to commission a study. I need to find someone to help me with this research to really look at quantifying and qualifying the actual benefits of this program. Mm-hmm. There was a study we read. I don't have the citation in front of me, but we used it recently. We had to advocate with the state. The state was talking about messing with the funding model. And so we really tried to lobby the state to say, look, don't mess with these programs because of all these other reasons. And there's actually some documentation that shows how beneficial these are. I mean, my parents don't live anywhere nearby. I wish they did. I would totally have them enroll. And I'm trying to see about developing, you know, online learning options, you know, simulcast options, things that people maybe that are less mobile could still engage mentally to still get some of that stimulation.
That'd be pretty incredible for an online opportunity.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I think there's so many people we aren't serving yet. Just my program serves 3,600 students. There's probably 10 or 15,000 easy, probably more like 30 or 40,000 older adults that live in this area, in the sort of surrounding community. So we can definitely expand the reach. The only way to do so, unless I get more instructional dollars, is online enrollment. So I can, you know, expand the capacity or find bigger classrooms.
I would do all of these courses. Go ahead.
So I guess my question to you is, for online enrollment, I mean, for the demographic that you're using, do you think that they would get the same benefit that they do, like, being together, like, in a classroom environment?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I probably wouldn't do it as pure online enrollment where you could just log in from your home and participate in the class that way. I think for this population, I probably would schedule it within residential living communities or big pockets of seniors, or maybe there's satellite classes, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So you still get some sort of social camaraderie with each other. Or say, look, you could do it from home, but only for one or two of the classes. You should also take some in person. So limit the amount that they can do online to try to encourage those that can come to campus to come to campus. Mm-hmm. So I think that social interaction is huge. I mean, honestly, so many of my students will get together for class and then go out to lunch afterwards. And these are their peer group. This is their network of friends. And I think whether we're doing social media for undergraduate students or looking at this population, the engagement, the interaction, that peer network is so important.
This has actually been a theme on our show lately because Jackie's in grad school right now taking online courses. And we definitely talk a lot about the pros and cons of the online experience versus the, you know, brick and mortar.
And yes,
I mean, Belmont doesn't have, I mean, we have a few online classes for specific things, but everything has a brick and mortar component, no matter kind of what you do. So it's kind of foreign to me because I've never taken online classes before. And that's why I've always found it very interesting to listen to Jackie, because she definitely has interesting experiences from that point.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. A lot of the online, when they're pure online, they still have some sort of residency program or some sort of in-person experience for a lot of fields. You know, I was at UC Riverside, University of California, Riverside, several positions ago, and the University of California system was exploring offering hybrid, lots of hybrid classes, where it would be maybe a Tuesday-Thursday class would be Tuesday online and Thursday in person, and you could use that exact same lecture hall on the flip schedule for another class, mm-hmm. which I think was mostly sort of a facilities-driven push, not necessarily purely for the online enrollment sort of piece, but it sort of worked both ways to increase capacity. I don't know how far along they went down that path, but I could see that being beneficial. And honestly, one of the biggest things we need to explore in higher ed, if I had a soapbox, so to speak, would be to explore, you know, how do
it's
we
a very get small right? soapbox, but we have people and they listen.
Yeah, see, like to find a way to explore proactively, what should student affairs look like in an increasingly hybrid or online world? How do we rethink student services in a way that engages students that might not be on campus, you know, even 50% of the time that they usually have been? And I think people are talking about it. There's lots of, you know, thought leaders on this, you know, in terms of exploring what that might look like or how to support, you know, student affairs leaders in social media and whatnot. But how do we think about all of our services, making them more available 24/7 online and using the chat bots? And how do we make it all personal? What does student engagement look like when we're only seeing students 40% of the time? 40% as much as what we used to 10 or 15 years ago. I don't have answers. I just have questions.
That's how you get answers, is to have questions. And that's one of the things that I actually love about the show is that, you know, Jackie and I are both social media people. And it's kind of awesome to actually talk about the issues in higher ed and what the future looks like. It's always refreshing to think about.
Yeah, like, how do we support student organizations to engage people that are on campus less often? How do we make student organizations function in an online environment, perhaps? And what would that even look like? I mean, we could go on totally different directions. Like, I've had so many questions about student organizations generally. Even 10 years ago, I was asking, how are we going to get our fraternities and sororities to deal with an increasing population that identifies as gender nonconforming, right?
Right.
As non-binary. And how do we support the organizations, but also the students? And how do we, so, you know, as those organizations evolve, because I'm sure they will, as sports teams evolve, as, you know, traditionally, quote unquote, traditionally, which I don't really like that term so much, single gender organizations evolve to expand their membership and support all the things that, you know, all the paradigm shifts that people need to go through. I mean, that's sort of a microcosm of sort of a bigger shift that we need to sort of, that we're swinging away from and hopefully back to in terms of, you know, society at large right now too, but we can't even go on to that. I can't even deal with that right now. Sorry, I always try to not get political and I always end up getting political.
Oh, it's not, I mean, but it's not a political thing. It is reality. I mean, it really is. I mean, you can think of it that way, I guess, but I like to think of it as just people are realizing things about themselves and, you know, society's changing, and that's something higher ed has to keep up with, on all sides. I mean, even if you're going to be as neutral politically as possible, you're going to have to be able to accommodate both sides. It's not about being, you know, liberal or conservative. It's just about being a good person and being a human, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's Logan's take on.
That was so nice. I want to.
Yeah, Logan's 2020. I like it.
Yeah.
This episode of Higher Ed Social is brought to you by Top Hat, the teaching app that makes active learning come to life. Top Hat is already helping thousands of college professors create their absolutely perfect course, both inside and outside of the classroom. Top Hat is a suite of easy-to-use apps to engage your class, adopt incredible next-generation textbooks, or even run tests within a secure digital environment. And best of all, it actually integrates with all the popular LMS systems, so you don't need any IT approval to get started. You can see why professors in over 700 colleges and universities across North America are already using Top Hat to power their classrooms at tophat.com/higheredsocial. So head over to TopHat.com/higheredsocial to learn more.
So I want to ask too, you mentioned that you have a bunch of side hustles going on. I know this is a drastic shift, but I'm interested to hear what they are and what are you working on now? What have you worked on? What are your dreams?
Oh, those are great questions. You know, I've done so much. It's so funny. I sort of fell into some opportunities. So a couple of years ago, there was an email on a listserv I was on asking for experts to write articles for a book called How to Survive Your Freshman Year. And I wrote to the person who sent the email, the publishers, and I said, yeah, I could write an article for you. But honestly, I've got 15 ideas for you right now, things that I think you need to add content-wise. We need to add much more than just a paragraph from professionals around the field. And I became their special editor, or co-special editor. So I started editing the book, adding a ton of ideas to it. I was probably one of the heavier marketers for the book. And just by sort of being gutsy, I guess, and saying, not only am I going to do something for you for free, I'm going to actually convince you to pay me to do something else. I became involved in this big production. And that was on the third edition. And now we've had the fourth edition, the fifth edition's come out. We were the 2012 About.com Reader's Choice Award winner. I know it's a dated reference. 2012 means nothing in 2018, but there hasn't been any award winner that I know of since. But we were the Reader's Choice in 2012 for the Best College Survival Guide. How mm-hmm. we beat out The Naked Roommate, I have no idea.
Yeah,
shout
I was going to say.
Shout out to Harlan, right? Like Harlan's, like, you know, there's a lot of people involved in that book. I have no idea how we beat that book out. Maybe the power of my social media reach, I guess. I don't know. but I love doing it. I don't even do it necessarily for the income. I really do it because I just like getting involved in different side projects. Mm-hmm. I've been a consultant for a few higher education tech vendors, like sort of third party, hired adjacent technology vendors. I've sort of helped them retool what they're doing, think about features that they might need that I know professionals like me would want, and help them sort of think about what that would look like for the end user. I'm also working, probably the one I'm most excited about right now, the one I'm really trying to work on is publishing children's books. I've been writing children's books off and on for years, have not published any of them, and I'm really trying. So if anybody knows anybody, you can hit me up at all my social media links and find me and connect me to someone. But I'm trying really hard to push that.
Well, our guest last week, Andrew, went on LinkedIn and I think found a literary agent and sent them a message, and that's how he's getting his book published. So
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cold calling is still a thing. Yeah, it's worth it.
That's so funny. So what are some go ahead.
No, I was just gonna tell you some of the books are a little different perhaps, but I have one I wrote probably in high school. So I don't even know how many years ago that was anymore, that I found and resurfaced. I retyped it because it was on a dot matrix printer. I don't know what floppy disk that was on. Retyped it. And it's a canine detective a la Sherlock Holmes, basically. And I've been sort of querying that, sending it to different publishers and agents to see if anyone likes that book. It's called Sherdog Bones. I know, super creative. Sherdog Bones. And Dr. Dotson, of course, is his assistant. And working on that, but I think most recently the one I just wrote was really inspired by a conversation with my daughter. She was 4 at the time. We were doing laundry, and she kept asking me why she was missing socks. And so instantly, the land of the missing socks was born. And so all these socks, they get transported from the dryer. They become sock animals, have their own little adventures.
Oh, that's adorable.
So that's where all my running socks went.
That's right. And of course, each book will have instructions at the end on how to make your own sock animal from your favorite lone sock. Thank God for Pinterest and Etsy, because I have no idea how to do that myself. I had to look it up myself. And maybe there'll be a whole Etsy page tied to it, or who knows what. The sequel is Lint Mountain, which is some sort of amusement park. And the third book, I don't know the whole story yet, but I know at some point they're going to fight and befriend the Socktopus. Which is basically a giant octopus sock.
I love that. I love that so much.
That's awesome.
That's so exciting. Can you, because I feel like as a child's book author, you have this responsibility to like throw in some jokes that like the kids won't get, but the parents will think are very funny.
Oh, I'm working on it. Oh, I mean, like, that assumes that I'm funny. I'm not really that funny, though.
I think you need to somehow, and I don't know where it'll land, but I think you somehow need to throw in a Tide Pod eating joke in there. Like, just lob that one in there.
Yeah,
right. A lot of laughs.
Like something like, you know, hey, this isn't the worst thing I could eat. Some sort of, like, little Tide Pod reference. You know, that's a good idea. Yeah, I'm not nearly as funny as I think I am. I sort of said that in my intro. I always wanted to sort of do amateur night at stand-up comedy. But the problem is I'm more sit-down funny. See, it takes a while. You got to cut out that whole pause right there
before,
the laugh track kicks in.
We'll edit in the laugh track for you. Sadly, we don't have it on this show, or else I would be probably a lot funnier.
That's funny. Probably. So years ago, UC, the University of California was doing a Promise for Education, like, crowdfunding campaign. So we had to pledge. I think I pledged for every $500 I raise for scholarships, I'll do a night of stand-up comedy. I raised $1,700.
Oh, my gosh.
Just from, like, crowdfunding. I haven't done the stand-up comedy night yet, so I still owe that to everyone. And I need to do probably multiples of those. But the problem is that my material is just – I've written jokes, but they're not that good. I mean, I've never been that kind of funny. I'm sort of – situational humor, one-off, wisecrack remarks you can't say out loud, but I still sometimes do. That's the kind of funny I am.
That I'm really excited to hear your first ever night of stand-up.
Oh yeah, when I do it, I'll make sure you can add that to the podcast feed.
Yes, that would be amazing.
I've got a whole routine built around, you know, the etiquette of men's restrooms, but it's not quite funny yet. It's just sort of like rules that are sort of funny but sort of weird. They can't really talk about in public, but I'm trying to build a routine around that.
There was a quiz once that went around the internet where it was like urinal etiquette, and you got to take the quiz, and it gave you different situations on like which one would you use, and I got a perfect score, so I feel really accomplished.
Nice, nice.
Got a perfect score.
Perfect score.
So what? With it being the summer. When it comes to work, what are you dealing with? Do you have classes over the summer, or is it just fall and spring?
So we do have a 6-week summer session that we're in the midst of right now. And it's a little bit leaner enrollment wise, but we do have probably still a good number of students, and they're in all the time. My students, as you can imagine, are super vocal, and I love them. They're great, but they will share any comment or concern or feedback about everything, which is great most of the time. Sometimes the feedback is a little bit less useful than others, but it's just, I mean, it's very, very busy at work, and we're about to do some facility upgrades. We have a 4-story building in the middle of sort of like near the beach in Santa Monica, but a 4-story building with one elevator for a program for students that are 55 and up, many of whom, I've got students that are 80, 90 years old still coming to class. So
we're trying to do some
facility fixes to try to make it, you know, like there's some loose tiles that I got to fix for safety reasons and stuff like that. So I have a long list of facility things. I'm also trying to do curriculum revision to revise the entire curriculum. I probably bit off more than I can chew for the first, you know, 9 months of the job, but trying to knock out a bunch of things to try to pave way for new improvements.
That's super exciting.
Yeah,
got a lot going on.
It's definitely different. I love what I do, and I'm glad that I'm here. Honestly, I love this position. You know, my goal has always been to be a vice chancellor of student affairs, VP student affairs. Maybe now that I've gotten the community college system, I could see an old dream of maybe becoming president sort of reawakening a little bit. You know, lots of schools, you can't be president unless you were faculty first. I don't really want to go down that route. But I really love public education. I love serving, you know, students of a diverse demographic. You know, and I've, now that I've experienced this other side of college life that I never knew even existed before, it's interesting. And it's interesting being on the non-credit side and seeing how to engage, how to apply what I've learned in student affairs to working with this different demographic. And 20 years ago, I know I'm sorry, I just keep talking, but 20 years ago, I worked for the city of Riverside working on senior services. So in a way, it's a little bit full circle, you know, sort of taking what I learned back then and trying to apply my student development lens to helping students of any age succeed in the educational pursuits they have, whatever they might be.
So what time of day do classes happen for folks in your program?
Yeah, well, our classes typically start at 9, although there's most of my, I do have a lot of students will show up at 8 a.m. for 9 o'clock class. They are very, very punctual, maybe even early. But 9 a.m., and we usually go till about, until about 5, Monday through Friday. We do have a few classes on Saturday as well. And some of my students also come to my same building at night for community education classes that are sometimes taught by the same people. So it's sort of, you know, we repurpose the same building for another program. And so some of them will come to campus for another thing later on that night. But 9 a.m., most of my classes are 2 hours, 2 to 3 hours long. Most of them are just one day a week, but then students can take up to 4 classes a semester, and many of them do. And in fact, years ago, they used to take 12 classes a semester, but we had to sort of, you know, draw that down a little bit in order to increase capacity. Yeah, some of them have asked me if I could open it back up. I said, well, we're not going to get to 12 again.
What are the time slots that you're taking 12 classes a semester?
I mean, I think they would literally just sort of camp out. So, you know, you're there from 9 to 11, 9 to 10:50, 11 to 12:50, and you know, do that 3 or 4 days a week. You can easily knock out that many classes. Now, that's not as many contact hours as a main campus class. You know, it's a 2-hour class or it's a 3-hour class. It's not, you know, it's not necessary. There's very few classes that are 2 days a week. And there's no assignments. There's no homework. So you come to class, you listen to a lecture. You might ask some questions with Q&A, or maybe you come to class and you're painting nude models for 3 hours, which is an awkward class to run into as the administrator, let me tell you.
Just popping in, saying, hey, oh, awkward. Yeah. I'm out. Gonna go.
Yeah, I had to go in to take care of a leak from a rainstorm, I guess, a few months ago, and did not realize that it was a nude model day. I thought it might have been a regular model day, and sure enough, it was. I got to work on a better system to sort of say, like, hey, you know, here are the, you know, this is the modeling day, or this is a regular painting day, just so people are forewarned.
Well, you have to sign a permission slip, obviously, before you go in.
Yeah, right. Of course. it's funny, though. I mean, like, my students live for, I mean, they love that class. If I can have that class, you know, 10 days a week, they would enroll for sure.
Yeah, I was going to ask what the most popular classes are.
I would say it's our gospel choir. And we have a couple of choirs, it's probably our music performance classes. So gospel choir, concert band, and then lots of anything in the art category, probably the most popular. We have one class that has only 99 seats, but 140 people enrolled. 140, that's current events. But somehow the faculty know that we average 30 to 40, or I guess 40 no-shows a week. So they know that they're never going to, you know, exceed the fire capacity. I don't know how they know this. I don't know how they manage it. It's like a layer of problems I have not explored yet. but yeah, that one's really popular. That's taught by someone who was formerly the mayor of Santa Monica, and he was a police chief in the city years ago. So he was heavily involved. He was also the executive vice president of Santa Monica College at some point. Really, really popular program. The concert band, actually, the gospel choir. Here's a funny story about the gospel choir. I walked into class with my dean, and just to observe, just to sort of see the class, because she said it's worth seeing. This is probably 1 month in on the job. Go into the class, see them sing. The students ask me to sing with them. And, of course, what I say to them is that ever since my bar mitzvah 20-odd, 30, whatever, years ago, I have not been permitted to sing in public. And sure enough, the 10 Jewish women who were in the gospel choir came down to see me afterwards and said, don't worry, we're Jewish. We're in the class too. It's okay. You can still sing. I said, still, I just, my singing voice is not so good. But it was just a nice, funny story about the gospel choir.
God said so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a good place to end the show this week.
Yeah, that is a wonderful note to end on.
Good. See, I was able to crack a joke in there after all. Look at that.
I tried.
Well, thanks, Scott, for joining us this week.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a lot of fun. Thank you so much. I think this is awesome, and I hope to, you know, do this again sometime.
Oh, yeah. Listeners, head down to higher-ed.social and get links to the stuff we talked about, including Scott's book that he was editor on. And subscribe to the show anywhere you listen to podcasts. If you like the show, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps people find us and lets us know what you think of the show. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at HES Podcasts. Send us a tweet. We love talking to you, and we'd love to know if you want to be on the show. We wanted to give a big thanks to our sponsor, Top Hat. don't forget to head to their website, tophat.com/higheredsocial, after you finish the show. Higher Ed Social is produced by Emma Haas and is part of the Connect EDU Network, the first podcast network for higher education. Visit the website, connectedu.network, and subscribe to some awesome shows no matter where you work on campus. Thanks, and have a great week.